American Enterprise, Philanthropic Business, Centrist Perspective. You're listening to The American Element. Welcome back to our second episode with Russ George. Today we're continuing our conversation about ocean pasture restoration, or iron fertilization as it is known in the press. In particular, we'll discuss the 2012 Haida Gwaii fertilization experiment, in which 12 men and women in a fishing boat distributed 100 tons of iron into the North Atlantic, creating a massive algae bloom designed to feed fish and sequester carbon dioxide on the ocean floor. We were intrigued by the idea of 12 people trying to change the climate of their planet and impact an entire ecosystem. 12 has a special significance in the military. It's the number of men and women in a Green Beret detachment when it goes behind enemy lines to disrupt enemy operations. Whatever your opinion may be about iron fertilization, it takes very few people and very little money to implement. And for that reason, it has the hallmarks of a disruptive technology, for better or worse. As climate change remains an open problem, it seems likely that disruptive technologies will be a focus of future efforts to find a solution. Russ, tell us about the 2012 experiment.
Well, that's also what drew me to John, was that, when I got the contact out of the blue from him, who he discovered me on the internet, and we started conversing in email and Skype. And he told me about being an officer in the Army Rangers, not just your average grunt soldier, but a guy who's in the elite team, mm-hmm. who's expected to do, work miracles with small numbers of people who are really dedicated and trained and
ideally.
Yeah, well, I think you are, right? And from my sense, having talked to you, you've been extremely well trained by the U.S. Army has gotten their monies, their investment has paid off big time.
For most of my career, I was just an expensive insurance policy.
Well, yeah, so you're still, but you're an active Army officer in the elite military team, and you train people to how to do more with less and to accomplish missions. And the fact that, that's sort of what I do in my life, not so much by joining a well-financed elite organization that can train us highly, but because I've never had the money to do anything more than that. So I'm always scrounging. And so the fact that, I could go out to sea with 11 Indian partners and do our project was good stuff. And then John, surprised me because I come from the kind of lefty side of the political spectrum, very green.
Yet ironically, the left has been more categorically opposed to iron fertilization than the right.
Well, and we're doing it anyway, right? Whether they give me a fair shake or not, we're sort of, I kind of run a commando operation in the world.
It has an almost Hollywood narrative. The rogue scientist cast out by the establishment when his work proves too controversial, forced to continue on his own.
Not that I do things in a rogue fashion. We spent years involved with government approval process to do our project in Canada.
They've disowned you, but they haven't really stopped you, have they?
Yeah, and I'm involved with a number of governments around the world right now doing, to repeat the work. But what appealed to me in talking to John is that there's this belief that certain things can only be accomplished by huge organizations and vast amounts of money and manpower. And the and climate change is one of those things, or bringing the fish back to the ocean, right? People think the only thing that will bring the fish back to the ocean is to go to war against the bad overfishing fishermen.
And you've stood in opposition to that us versus the carbon producer mentality in the environmentalist movement. But your tech team is also modern in the sense that technology is increasingly wielded by small teams.
Yeah, and we were pretty sophisticated. It was a small team I had, but we did the Canadian Space Agency had conducted a special week-long training session with my team to teach us gave us access to the fleet of global Earth-observing satellites. And so our laptops were loaded with software so that we could call up the satellite data, just like a special forces team in the field. And we had drones. We had two of the most sophisticated ocean drones that could go out on 30-day missions independently, and they would swim. They would porpoise up and down through the ocean, and every 2 hours they would surf. After diving down to 1,000 meters deep, they'd come back up to the top, and they'd measured 100 different parameters to every 2 seconds. And as soon as they were on the surface, they'd dial up the satellite, and my iPad would beep, and the drone would speak to me, and it would say, "I'm on the surface. I'm at this location. Here's what I just saw."
Let's talk about fish. How do you view the outcome of the 2012 experiment?
The fact of the matter is that I've proven that in the Gulf of Alaska we could bring the salmon back to the greatest historic abundance, health and abundance that's ever been seen. Mm-hmm. So take for instance tuna in the Pacific Ocean. The giant bluefin tuna is now down to less than 3% of its historic numbers. And, you know, they're on the road to extinction, and not because of overfishing, which is certainly happening, but primarily because they have nothing to eat. So they're starving.
And it's not just the fish that are starving. It's also the people that rely on them.
Well, yeah, no, and I've been contacted by nations all over the world now who, having seen the results in the Gulf of Alaska, have contacted me. And prime ministers and presidents who have contacted me and said, "Can you please come to our country and bring our fish back? Help bring our fish back, just like you did for the native people of Canada." And I said, "Yeah, we can do that." And they asked me, "Well, how effective do you think it might be?" And the reality is that if I can raise a small Army Ranger corps of about 100, a centurion legion, 100 people, we can do enough projects to bring back and deliver into fishing nets and onto the plates of people 1 billion additional fish, right? And if you think about that, if a billion additional fish are produced and each fish, you know, provides 10 meals, yeah. These are big fish, tuna and the likes, mm-hmm. You know, that's enough food to... in any place where people have access to fish, to end world hunger. And the cost of that is a mere 100 people, mm-hmm. Right? If 100 people, you know, sign up to lift on their shoulder, you know, 50-pound bags of rock dust, that's all it takes.
That's an appealing narrative, but it seems that the benefits are outweighed by the unknowns in the minds of your opponents.
Well, the benefit is that it works to bring the fish back. I mean, when my work became, you know, attacked by everybody and his brother, you know, the Greens and the government of Canada and scientific groups who were enraged that we'd done this work, yeah. Because it worked so well, mm-hmm. And because it threatened their climate change marketplace, yeah. Where they were going to earn trillions. And we'd shown that instead of the world having to raise trillions in climate taxes, it merely needed to raise tens of millions of dollars to bring the fish back. Yep. And the fish would feed the world and coincidentally take care of the lion's share of the world's carbon dioxide problem. Well, the idea that you can do that with 100 people, mm-hmm. is about as transformational as you could possibly get, and it threatens the daylights out of a lot of people.
It makes sense that what you're doing is seen as weird, frightening, and maybe even unnecessary, although as these problems are recognized as severe and without a solution, maybe that attitude will change.
And so but it just works. Mm-hmm. You know, it works, and it works immediately, right? It doesn't take decades to prove the results. The results, you know, the beauty about the biology, the ecology, the ocean is a place that blooms. It's mm-hmm. mostly the reason why, you know, we like the clear blue sea. That picture is everybody's mind. Well, when the sea is clear and blue, there's nothing growing there. Sure. When life is really growing in the sea, it looks like pea soup, right? And that's a bloom. That's a plankton bloom. Well,
do you think humans have an incomplete understanding of plankton, considering our dislike of water that isn't crystal clear?
Well, people think about the ocean and they say it's the ocean, as if it's all a uniform. Yeah. So if we have a plankton bloom that's been in the local news reports about that's in the local bay or coastline, we think, oh, plankton blooms, and it's caused a problem. We think plankton blooms are bad. But that's like...
Maybe we need to adjust that attitude to plankton then.
Yeah, but 72% of the planet is ocean, and less than 1% of that ocean is coastline, is near the shoreline. So the vast majority of the world's oceans are far out to sea, and harmful plankton blooms have never been observed to take place in the open ocean. Right? Mm-hmm. They take place near shore. So that's always been a bit of a red herring, no pun intended, in the fish world here. Yep. But, you know, the good news about this is when I, and what really is made me happy to work with John here is that I, you know, I suddenly had to come to grips with my own kind of misunderstanding of, you know, what do military guys do and think about, right? And so, you know, what John and some of his colleagues in the Army Rangers think about, they get well-trained to think about how to solve problems with solutions that are good enough. They don't have to be perfect, and that's what I do. I work with solutions that are good enough. I don't claim that my work is the end-all, be-all, you know, one single magic silver bullet that will solve all of the climate change problems. But it's a heck of a big chunk of the solution, and it's good enough for now, and it has lots of benefits. And so that's it's nice to work with John and come up brainstorming with him about what to do.
What's your response to the criticism of your work by the mainstream media?
No, the mainstream media has its own agenda, right? And they like to talk about problems. And when suddenly incredibly simple, inexpensive solutions show up to those problems, they've lost their story, right? And so the media hates solutions.
But your work has managed to enrage the left, right, and center, and there's almost no recognition that the Canadian government and environmental scientists were involved in the 2012 experiment. Why is their narrative so different from yours?
Well, I figure I had to be in the middle ground and in the right when one day in the press I was attacked by the far-left organizations, you know, the World Wildlife Fund and Greenpeace and... And Sea Shepherd Society, and on the same day, Rush Limbaugh attacked me from the far right. And then following that, some of the most positive stories that have been written in the media about me were published in the National Review, in the most right-wing, conservative media there is. So,
what do you think the future is for iron fertilization, considering its sensational treatment in the media?
Yeah, well, it's sensationally effective. It's just not very sensational in the, you know, if you have only if something only takes 12 people and an old rusty fish boat to accomplish, you know. I mean the reality is that it just works so incredibly well on so many fronts, and it's so ridiculously low cost, you know, that it's bound to happen.
I mean, you're saying that iron fertilization can't be stopped because it's so cheap and simple, which is something you run into in the military as well. Oftentimes, you can't stop an insurgent from picking up a weapon because it's so cheap for him to do so.
And I was telling John, you know, one of the reasons I liked this meeting him is that, trying to reach out and explain this kind of geeky ocean science stuff to people and inspire people, or climate change stuff, you know, trying to inspire a lot of people, it's just not something they want to do, you know. And I said, you know, well, but if there are, you know, young people who are thinking of what to do with their lives, and they're thinking about, well, maybe they'd like to be in the Army because they like all the excitement and action. Well, you know, we have an alternative sort of, you know, special forces.
Do you think iron fertilization could appeal to people who are turned off by the bureaucracy and limited impact of other treatments to global warming?
Yeah. I mean, the Paris Accord, which met a year ago in Paris, right? 40,000 people descended on Paris to negotiate the Paris Accord, to participate in that. Well, you know, I'm talking about 100 people are needed to, you know, do the lion's share of the work to save the planet.
You just need a few good men, which makes iron fertilization a potentially cheap fix, but if it's the only solution to a slow-moving car crash...
Oh, yeah, it's a huge emergency, right?
It is, and it seems like we're only just coming to terms with the seriousness of the situation. And in the parlance of my generation, if there's a hack to the problem, then it should be considered objectively.
Yeah, well, this is a good hacking of the planet, you know, restoring, hacking the planet back to life, right? And it has been a mystery to me why I have enemies on both sides. You know, I never would have thought, like, one of my favorite writers who's written positive stuff about me is a guy named Robert Zubrin, who's written in the National Review, and you don't get a more conservative publication than the National Review, and Robert loves my work because he saw it as, you know, being a solution to this grand argument that's going on between the right and the left, right, where the left wants the grand environmental solution and the punishment of the wrongdoers, and the right doesn't want to pay the bill.
We're talking today in the wake of the inauguration of Donald Trump and national division like few other times in our history. How do you think global warming and iron fertilization in particular will fare in this new political climate?
Yeah, so I have some hope that, you know, Donald Trump as the next president and the people that he's going to bring in around him, who many of whom are speaking out against climate change, but what they're really speaking out about is against the cost of the solution to climate change. Well, here's a technology that appeals to Army Ranger guys, right? Must be something good about it. And then that simply works fabulously effectively. It can resolve as much of the problem as the Paris Accord seeks to resolve for an inconsequential sum of money. And so I'm hoping that, you know, President Trump will say, well, why don't we spend the few tens of millions of dollars it takes to bring the oceans back to health, and we'll take the lion's share of the argument about climate change off the table. Right? I mean, that's a perfect solution.
You're saying that if Donald Trump could support anything in the climate change movement, maybe he could support iron fertilization simply for its rogue status, which is a prayer in an otherwise bleak moment for the American climate change movement. But how would you describe this solution to other potential supporters?
Well, this is Mother Nature's solution, right? So, you know, people have put me into the category of geoengineering, which I always recoil at because... You know, I'm sort of saying, well, is planting a tree geoengineering? I guess, you know, maybe it is, right? And if that's geoengineering, then I'm okay with it, with being called a geoengineer. But
well, it's one of those loaded terms like GMO that drive people crazy. And there's a great TED talk by Michael Spector called The Dangers of Science Denial that discusses how emotional our responses can be to these terms.
That's right. And so you know, we have a new, you know, very conservative, libertarian-oriented, you know, American administration about to begin, mm-hmm. who hopefully are looking for, you know, things that just work, right? Especially things that work and don't cost a lot of money, right? And so, you know, this is one of those technologies that can do that.
Thank you so much for talking to me today, Russ. To learn more about iron fertilization, please go to theamericanelement.com, where you'll find our other episode with Russ and our standalone article further discussing this complex issue. We talk about the history of iron fertilization, its major players, and the controversy surrounding it in greater detail. Thank you.